journeys on Revolution Radio on freedomslips.com and simulcast with wolfspiritradio.com. Join JP, your tour guide today, on this journey of discovery from the known to the unknown in search of enlightenment, knowledge, and truth. Greetings, sisters and brothers. Tonight is, it's the seventh month, it's 1702 PST. It is, what the heck day is it? Oh, it's the 15th. Oh, well, it doesn't even add up to seven. My guest tonight is Ms. Seven. Her numbers, her rays are 147. She's 17. You'll hear about all the sevens. And all the different sevens, and some of the serious sevens, as well as some of the more light-hearted sevens. So, without further too much ado, introduce yourself, Ms. Seven, because there is a lot of mystery and intrigue in yourself. So, I hope that you wish to demystify yourself and. Express, because you've got a lot to express, without any ado, good evening, how are you doing? You're speaking from London, aren't you?
Yes, I'm speaking from London. Thank you for inviting me onto your show. It is a great privilege, so thank you. And thank you to all the listeners out there, you know, saying a big howdy to you all, a big hug to you all. And yeah, where should we start?
Well, there's a good thing. Where do we start? Where did you start? You were born, you grew up. What happened?
Yes.
Was it normal? What's normal?
Is it, what is normal? I'm sort of born and bred in London, West London, predominantly central London. My journey in relation to where I am at this present moment in time that led me here began with my brother, who passed on in 1992. Basically, my brother was what is probably would be considered now in today's world as an ascended master. At the time, I knew he was a very special person, but I didn't realize just how special he was until I got to the point that I'm at today. My brother was very ill, and he was an asthmatic. And in fact, we were both asthmatic as children. And I had a very interesting relationship with him. He was my eldest brother, and I am the youngest in my family. I'm the seventh child, in fact, and that's where the seven comes from. My brother exposed me to lots of interesting spiritual teachings when I was a young lassie, a young lady. I was exposed to things like Sanskrit and various different Tibetan philosophies, and it sort of ignited my interest in the spiritual, really. My spiritual journey really began with my eldest brother. He was very, very ill, and I had a very unique relationship with him, possibly because we were both asthmatic and the only two people in my family that were. We had what is probably called a telepathic relationship. He used to get very, very, very sick and have asthma attacks, and we would be in different locations at different times, but I could actually hear my brother calling my name. And there were countless times, throughout my childhood of me finding my brother, you know, being somewhere out or whatever, and basically hearing my brother calling me and having to sort of drop everything and go and look for him, and finding him sort of almost passed out in the middle of a quite heavy asthma attack. I've had lots of experiences with him screeching through the streets in an ambulance, rushing him to hospital and telling them that he's not going to die, he'll live, you know. This went on throughout my childhood and my early adulthood until he actually passed in 1992. At which point I actually decided that I wanted to do something as a tribute to him, because he was a very special person. Not just because he was my brother, but and because he was someone that was very learned. He was very briefed and very knowledgeable of all so much stuff. I mean, he studied etymology, various different spiritual systems. He was a graphic artist, and he was a genius, really. He was a very incredibly gifted, talented person. And when he passed in 92 at the age of 30, I wanted to do something that would be as a legacy to him. At the time, I was a musician. I used to do sessions for various different people. I was mostly self-taught throughout my childhood. I taught myself to play guitar and bass and various other instruments. And by the time I got to my teens and sort of 20s, I actually started getting propositions to do sessions for people. I've worked with people like Robert Palmer, you know, did kind of all the top of the pops type things that were around at the time. And when my brother passed, I decided I wanted to do something, because I was in the entertainment industry anyway, to address health and fitness in a way that would resonate with the larger populace and sort of tap into the collective consciousness of humanity, if you like. And at the time, I was also surrounded by lots of creative people. I grew up in a very creative environment. Everybody I knew was either a writer or a dancer or a musician. I used to dance myself. And basically, these became the things that sort of I incorporated into what became a multimedia platform. I did a lot of research. I went to hospitals, talking to various different people that were suffering from drug abuse or mental illness. I also did look after a couple of people that had strokes, and realized at the time that there wasn't a great deal to address these things within mainstream entertainment. So I set about basically doing the kind of due diligence and groundwork and research to create this multimedia platform, which would be sort of interactive. Now, this was around sort of mid to late 90s. At the time, it was the birth of the internet, and I realized that you could, you know, reach a great deal of people if you combined a mainstream entertainment and made it interactive in various different ways. So I put this thing together, and around 2002, I became ill myself, even though I'm actually quite a health-orientated person. I've always been into health, and because my brother was ill and I was ill as a child, and I think also in my family, health has always been something that we paid a lot of attention to. So I actually spent a great deal of time researching what would help people. I'm a solutions-based person more than a problem-based person. I tend to like to look at what an issue is and look for solutions that would translate to a large amount of people. And that's basically what I wanted to do with my multimedia platform. Now, in 2002, I actually had, I think it was laryngitis quite chronically, and was being treated in the hospital. And at the time, I remember, because they didn't actually know why my larynx were inflamed, I ended up in hospital for about 2 or 3 days while they did a number of tests on me. When I got home, I actually was sitting around and flicking through the channels, as it were, and realized that there wasn't a great deal for people that were, you know, kind of immobilized or rehabilitating or whatever, as far as addressing health and fitness was concerned. So I thought it would be a good time to relaunch my multimedia platform as I had developed it. So what I did was I contacted the Law Society in London and said, look, I live in central London. I actually want to launch something, but I want to find a very good lawyer to protect my intellectual property rights. They gave me the name of a law firm based on more to do with jurisdiction, you know, where I lived, rather than that this law firm was particularly good. That's something that I didn't realize at the time. They just sort of gave me a law firm name, and I contacted the law firm, went to see them in 2003, and the law firm's name is Russell's. They're a law firm that's based in central London. And I had an appointment with them, went to see them, and they took along my multimedia platform. Now, at the time, I was not as aware, unfortunately, as I am today after my experience. I went along specifically to protect the intellectual property rights. And so I was appointed with a young man called Christopher Gossage, who signed confidentiality agreements with me and contracts, and basically before my disclosing my documents to him, was very clear to me that he would protect everything that we discussed at the time. Now, he signed all the confidentiality before we looked at the documents, and I thought, okay, you know, he signed it, it's going to be safe. So I showed him my work, and he was basically having kittens by the time he saw it. He said, did you do all this yourself? And I said, yeah. Now, as I said, my brother had died, and this was a legacy to him. So like you do when you create something for somebody that you love, particularly in the circumstances of his passing, I actually wanted to something that would be a tribute to his life as a very special person. And so there was a lot of time and love invested in it. So by the time it got to Christopher Gossage's eyes, it was very potent, and he was basically salivating. He was sitting there shocked. He said, did you create all this yourself? And I was like, yeah, you know. Now, at the time, I looked a lot younger than I am, because I guess I just looked very young for my age. I was about 38 at the time and looked something like probably about 17 or something ridiculous like that. But he thought I was a lot younger, and I suppose that was a motivating factor for him to engineer what subsequently took place. Now, he had tipped off various different media networks that I had developed this project. Now, to my face, he was saying, okay, yeah, we're going to take it to Endemol, we're going to talk to this person and that person and organize licensing deals. And, you know, he was very excited about it. And by his reaction, I thought, okay, you know, you've got to have a record of this. So what I did from that point onward was to communicate with him via email. So I have a very large record of what took place at that time. So officially, I became their client around the 9th of June in 2003. And from that point onwards, I was not aware, but he had tipped off various different networks about what I had created. And so from then on, months leading up to November, I started getting headhunted by a man called Richard Hanna, who was from working with NTL and Clarion Television. Now, he basically suggested that I would have to take a risk in one shape or form, so why not take the risk with him? He had contacted someone called Helen Alexander, who was from Scottish Media Groups, and organized a meeting for us to kick off on the 11th of November in 2003. Now, at the time, I actually was very clear about what I wanted to do. I had already put together a production team made out of dancers. I had an Olympic athlete involved, Juan Fernandez, he was called, who he is called, I should say. And basically, I had already had a game plan, and it was all, I was only interested in protecting, legally protecting my rights, because I knew I'd created something of that would be significant in some way. But and what I, if hold on one second, because I think there's a lot of feedback going on from this end. Can you hear feedback on your end?
No, it's absolutely crystal clear, Seven. You're doing really well.
Oh, okay.
You're coming through very, very clearly, so don't worry about what's coming back. I'm muted, actually, so unless...
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. It's just that I'm hearing, like, feedback coming back from this end.
All right.
All right. I think
okay, so don't worry about
this
it.
This is the other room I've got. I'm with a techie here. Okay, I just wanted to check that. Yeah, so basically, this Richard Hanna guy was, you know, basically chasing me with an obsession to get me to attend this meeting in NTL's Feltham facilities, which had been quite newly created at the time. Now, there's a whole story about that, because NTL at that particular time had built this massive broadcasting facilities with satellite capabilities and surveillance, etc. It was a pretty big affair, and they had built it specifically to launch sports productions in the UK and lost the contract to Sky. Now, I think if people did research, they'd find this information. It's all in the public domain. So this was around 2003. So they built these big, massive facilities and lost the deal and found themselves in debt. And they were desperate for something to turn the thing around. I had no idea at the time that they were looking to do it with my multimedia platform to launch health and fitness productions. But that's exactly what took place. There were a number of emails exchanged between the parties, one of which I got hold of, and the contents of the email were on my command, unleash sales hell. And it said stuff about this guy, Richard Hanna, being he called himself Maximus TV selling us, and stated that he would have his revenge during the meeting that I was scheduled to attend, and this email referenced murder and all kinds of bizarre things. But I didn't actually get any of this information until after the fact, unfortunately. He also used another identity of someone else, But what happened was, before I actually went to the meeting, my computer crashed. So I wasn't able to pull up any of the stuff until after the meeting. And if I had done, I wouldn't have attended. I did ask my lawyers at the time to attend the meeting with me, but they declined. They gave me copyright statements to prove that I was the copyright owner and contracts for them to the parties to sign. So I actually went along to the meeting with one of the witnesses who ended up being witness in my case, Lisa Pane, who at that time was a law graduate. And she was one of the witnesses who co-signed at the meeting for the disclosing of my documents. Anyway, cut a very long story short, these documents were stolen by Helen Alexander. And basically, we tried very, very hard for a number of months to get the documents back from her, and discovered that she had entered into deals internationally and throughout the UK with various different production houses for my work. And by December of 2003, I started seeing advertisements on television on Channel 4 and I believe BBC. All of them were sort of launching these new productions which outlined everything that were in my stolen documents. And so at that point, I went to find lawyers. I tried to get in contact with the lawyers that I had, Russell's media law firm and Christopher Gossage, but they completely stopped taking my telephone calls. I left message after message, and they just completely ignored me from that point onwards. They didn't terminate the contract with me officially. I believe what happened was that they came up with the plan to unleash sales hell with my documents, and that's exactly what they did. There was a selling frenzy. They kind of converted the works into a number of productions, and these were launched throughout the United Kingdom and also internationally in America and all the different territories, basically. And once I saw this, I actually tried to get other lawyers. Now, I went to see a lawyer. I brought all the emails proving that the negotiations were taking place. I brought the signed contracts. I brought lots of my research to show that I was the copyright owner of all these works. And he said, well, you've got a lot of evidence. You know, let me do some phone calls and I'll get back to you. He made a few phone calls, came back to me saying, well, you do have a case, but there's going to be a conflict of interest, so I can't take your case anymore. But you definitely should sue your previous lawyers, and because what they did was bang out of order. Now, it appeared to me and to us, because I was with Lisa Pane at these initial meetings with lawyers about taking legal action, it became evident that they probably offered him a substantial amount of money not to take on my case. So from that point onwards, it became a quest to get a lawyer in order to take on the case and fight for the right of something that for me was very, very sacred. It wasn't just an idea that they took. They took years of research, and, you know, it was a legacy and a tribute to my brother. And the fact that these people could just take it and sell it all over the world was just an insult upon insult, you know, for me. So we did try to get the documents back. We went to the Met Police in Paddington Green Police Station, London. And were given a crime file and was told that CID would have been in touch with me. And, of course, CID never did get in contact. Myself and witnesses, we sat around for weeks upon weeks waiting for CID, and nobody ever got in contact with us. Now, at the time, after going to the police, is when the sinister side started kicking off. My house was surrounded with surveillance vehicles. White transit vans were parked outside, seen outside my house, literally day and night, 24/7. And I started getting very threatening telephone calls and death threats and all such like. And that was the birth of what began a, has been a 10-year targeting operation to silence me. Anyway, just to kind of pull it back a little bit, I actually, by 2004, this kind of targeting operation was in full effect. Opposite where I live was put into place a surveillance operation that was filming my apartment, filming my movements. I was followed on a daily basis. I experienced going to visit people and the same vans that were outside of my house suddenly appearing outside wherever else I was. You know, so if I was visiting someone, we'd look outside the window and the vans would be outside of those places as well. And on one occasion, I was walking with my mother. We went to visit my brother, and we were tailed along the street as we walked on the pavement. And there was a white transit van with two men wearing balaclavas, and they were making slit my throat signs at me. They were gesturing to slit my throat, and that kind of thing was taking place like on a daily basis. It got absolutely became a nightmare. It's very difficult, and you know, to express what went on at that time, mainly because now I try to, you know, see the light and remain positive. But in order to convey the story and the experience that I've had, I have to open doors that I don't necessarily always want to look at. But because it has a place in the public domain, and historically, because of some events that took place, I have to do that. I feel a duty to do that in relation to some of the things that transpired subsequently. So, so basically 2004, I was still in pursuit of getting lawyers. I ended up being given a law firm to go and see called Beinman and Partners. Now, Beinman and Partners were apparently, supposedly, a human rights law firm with a media kind of slant, if you like. They represented BBC and various different other people in the media. And I was told I should go and talk to them. But what happened was, I actually, because of the nature of the case and because I became aware that a lot of solicitors, if you go to see them with a case with the magnitude of my case in terms of the monetary side of it, the work I was doing was very successful. It was on mainstream television, family kind of orientated TV shows. And the last thing they wanted was the public becoming aware of what was really behind these TV shows. So there were lots of lawyers that were being paid to kind of find out what evidence I had and sort of circumvent it and sabotage it in some way or another. So because of this, I actually drafted a confidentiality agreement before going to see Beinman and Partners so that they would sign and not anything that I was disclosing to them, not pass it over to the other side. And so when I went to see this lawyer, Tamsin Allen, this was around February of 2004. When I went to see her, I actually came with this printed confidentiality agreement, and I also brought the floppy disk. At the time, I was still using floppy disk. That's how old it this is. But yeah, so I had the floppy disk in hand and went to see her with it, because I thought, well, she may well want to change some of the clauses in the agreement. But what transpired was she stole the floppy disk, and the floppy disk had a script that I'd written on it. And it didn't take very long for that to surface as well. So as along with my multimedia platform, which was being sold quite ferociously worldwide, came the selling of my script.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes.
You keep using this term multimedia platform.
Yes.
And obviously that's a very generic term. And
yes.
Is it because that this thing exists as a branded item that you do not wish to refer to as the branded item because you're in dispute with it? Is that right?
No. I won the case in 2006, and it was covered up, but I actually officially won the case, even though they've covered it up, and there's been a lot of corruption around that. But no, I'm that's basically the easiest way for me to express what it was that I created. And it was a series of three documents that got stolen, and it comprised of binded the binding of the actual concept and who I wanted to appear in it. It basically was very comprehensive documents outlaying the launching of productions, TV productions predominantly, and merchandising of health and fitness orientated television shows. And the reason why it's multimedia is because it was interactive. So it was written in a way that was to incorporate the internet as much as it was to incorporate mainstream television. And that's basically why I use that term. It's not because of just any lawsuit that's pending or anything like that, although I have to say, because it's been covered up, we have had to create a report on what has transpired within the judiciary, the corruption that has been involved in protecting the cartel that's involved. So that's basically why I use that term. So
right.
Shall I continue?
Well, hang on a second. I still want to drill down onto this a little bit so that. Because,
yeah,
you know what you're talking about, right?
Yes.
And my listeners certainly, and even myself, you got a big story here. Okay. And we're working with your description of it. So a multimedia platform, is it something that, are you talking like something like a Wii? Something like a health and fitness program, or is it a TV show that has a particular philosophy behind it that is unique? What was different about what you had? And
okay, well, one of the things that I did before in the creation of this thing was to do a hell of a lot of research into TV productions and what kind of TV shows had existed before my work. And there had been nothing remotely like what I had created at all. There wasn't any TV productions that were addressing health and fitness in the same way that I wanted to do it, which was to make it in the same way you see there's lots of different TV formats for property, if you like. There's location, location, location. There's I don't know, house and gardens. There's so many different formats, TV formats that address houses, for instance, and relocating and What else? So I'm basically renovating. There's a lot of formats that cover that, but there wasn't anything that covered prior to the theft of my work. There wasn't TV formats that covered health and fitness and addressing the public's health and fitness in the way that I had done it. And so basically at that time, I think reality TV was just kicking off. Endemol, you had the Big Brother type productions. But there wasn't anything remotely like I had created. And I'll give you an idea of some of the TV shows that we're talking about. You might, if some of your listeners may well have seen or watched Dancing with Stars, Diet Doctors, You Are What You Eat, 10 Years Younger, Fat Nation, there was The Games, which was another one that was derivative from my work. But as I told you, my script was also in the midst of my platform being converted into a multitude of television productions and TV formats that are very successful and still running today. My script was converted and also turned into a number of productions which some people might have heard of, but we can get into that as we progress, if you like. But just to help you a little bit, it basically was to launch interactive television formats that would address in a way health and fitness using dance, looking at the nation's health in much the same way that these productions do. Well, because they came from the work that I completed. So some of you might have heard of Fit Farm, Diet Doctors, and You Are What You Eat. Have you heard of those shows? 10 Years Younger?
I haven't watched TV for about, well, especially this kind of TV, for at least 10, 12 years now.
Okay, you know, then it will be...
I'm not TV fodder,
I mean, so you would...
When you're talking about a multimedia...
Strictly Come Dancing...
I'm sorry?
Have you heard of Strictly Come Dancing, Dancing with Stars, Dancing on Ice?
Oh, yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah, okay. I mean, even if you don't watch TV, these are very, very big productions now worldwide. So, I mean, even if you don't watch them...
And so the creation of a format like this is something that is a valuable trade, because creativity doesn't come that easily to this group of people. Is that right?
Well, the people in question are parasites. As I said... I explained in the outset with the NTL thing, they had lost
the contract. Hang on a second. Not everybody knows who NTL are, so who are NTL?
Okay. NTL are Telecommunications and Broadcasting Corporation. They have since disbanded and they are better known now as Virgin Media. Have you heard of Virgin Media?
Yes, the most expensive broadband you can buy in Britain.
Well, yeah, that and other things, believe me. They rebranded as a consequence to me winning my case in 2006. They changed their name. They were NTL beforehand. But with my lawsuit, because I actually unearthed not just my, complaints against them, but they had been reported 26 times to the Advertising Standards Association for inciting criminality and theft and all sorts of things. So they were pretty much known as a rogue company that were going around advocating theft of people's property. And in fact, they were also quite well known for a software known as eDonkey, which is a file sharing program which gives you the facility to hack into people's computers and steal their information. And so, NTL had become synonymous with that. But yeah, they're a very big telecommunications company. As I said, they actually had loaned a vast amount of money from, I believe, a Japanese company of, I don't know exactly which Japanese company it was, but they actually loaned a lot of money to build these facilities in Feltham, which is massive. I mean, we were taken there for the meeting in 2003 when I actually met these lunatics. And, yeah, the place was absolutely humongous, the size of an airport, if not bigger. And they had offices, rows and rows and rows of offices that were all empty. And I asked them, I said, why have you taken us to this empty facilities? And that's when we discovered that, you know, they'd lost all this money and they were looking for some way to be able to put the machinery to use. And my proposals and my documents outlining these health and fitness productions became their vehicle for how they managed to go from being bankrupt to being worth 27 point something billion pounds within a record amount of time within the same year. And so, just in short, yeah.
Oh, it was going so well.
Facilities of broadband and all that type of thing. But they also were very much involved in broadcasting and wanted to be, and ended up becoming one of the biggest companies on the proceeds of organized crime, basically. And so the productions that I have just mentioned to you, the television productions, came into being by this whole organized crime operation, which was absolutely massive. It was very, very big. And as a consequence, I was put on a program to ensure that the truth of what was going on would never come to light. And that's what spawned me on to taking my lawsuit. But before my lawsuit came into being, I think I initially put my case into the Royal Courts of Justice Chancery Division on the 5th of August 2004. And for anybody that wants to have a look at any of this information, there is a website called The Farrell Report, www.thefarrell.net. You can have a look. There is a main report and there's appendices which covers some of the court skeleton arguments. You can have a look at the affidavits and witness statements and also the crime logs that were with the police. In the appendices to the report, there's something like 65 police crime logs, which have never, not one has been followed up by the Met Police. And effectively, I was left to rot in a very horrific situation up until this report going live. You know, basically my life has been one of a fugitive and pretty much a very, very nightmarish scenario. So, but anyone that wants to have a look, you can actually, I'm looking at the report in my hand so that I can refer you to pages so that you can have a look at stuff as I explain the story. I have to say that the report is about 250 pages and it is a condensed from thousands of documents that were before the courts in 2006. And so we had to shorten it, otherwise we would never have got to the end of actually finishing this report because there was just too much evidence. And so what we've done is taken key pieces of evidence in relation to everything that I discussed so that people can have a look for themselves. So if you're interested, log to Farrell, and you'll see a website, and at the side there are links, and there's an introduction from Tony Farrell. Tony Farrell has turned whistleblower. He was UK's top senior intelligence analyst, principal intelligence analyst for the police. He worked for South Yorkshire Police for about 17 years, I believe, and he actually became a whistleblower because he was asked to write an assessment, a threat assessment, into whether there was Islamic terrorism or a threat of Islamic terrorism in the UK. And after compiling lots of data and research himself, he realized that the threat was internal and it wasn't from extreme factors, which they wanted him to write. And he refused to do so, so he got sacked. I believe he was sacked in 2010, and that's how I actually got to meet him at a protest, but we can talk about that a bit later. But so Tony Farrell and I, over the last 6 months, had compiled a large portion of the evidence pertaining to the court case and also subsequent to the court case and prior to the court case, and put it into this report. So you can have a look. It's very comprehensive and will give anybody a first-hand view of the life of a targeted individual, and also the background to what became the 7/7 bombings, and also the shooting of Jean-Charles Menendez, the innocent, I should say, Brazilian young man that was shot 7 times in the head. The official narrative, we all know, is a load of cock and bull. It's completely bogus, and Tony Farrell has been instrumental in discussing that and bringing that to light. And there are a number of us, actually. There's John Anthony Hill, who took a case, and he made a documentary some people might have seen called The Ripple Effect. And in that documentary, he did his own research into what he saw was a complete cover-up, and actually ended up being incarcerated, and because he sent a DVD to the trial of 4 innocent Muslims, so that the jury and the judge could see evidence that these men were innocent. I believe the men were found innocent at the end of it, but John Anthony Hill did spend time in prison. He was imprisoned because of that. And so myself, having another piece of the pie, if you like, another vantage point, have come together with these people and have produced this report and a website so that the public can see for themselves the facts. My case in particular details what happened prior to the London bombings, what led up to it, and certainly a factor of what led up to it. What John Anthony Hill done was a comprehensive research into what the official narrative said and actually the facts. He looked at them very, very closely and made a very explosive, brilliant documentary called The Ripple Effect. There is a part one and a part two, and I recommend that anybody who's interested in the subject of what happened with 7/7 have a look at that. And of course, Tony Farrell, you can Google him and you'll find out who he is. And he's a very spiritual individual, a Christian and a Bible-believing Christian, and he's a man of the utmost integrity. He's very, very honourable, and my path led to him sometime last year at a protest outside the Independent Police Complaints Commission, the IPCC. And that's where I actually met him and basically put this report together since that time. It's been 6 months in the making, but it's there for everybody to see. So in relation to the multimedia platform and how it sort of transpired, you can go to page 48 of the actual Farrell report and 49. 48 will show you some of the productions, and 49 will show you the beneficiaries, that being BBC, ITV, Endemol, NTL, Virgin Media, Celador, Channel 4, just to name a few. But you can have a look. You can also see I have an affidavit printed here. The actual full affidavit is in the appendices. I'm not sure what, because they're categorized A, B, C, D. I'm not sure which one it is, but if you flip through, you'll see, you'll come to the actual, affidavit. Now, the affidavit, I have to mention legally, because not everybody's aware of law. An affidavit statement, basically, is sworn to sort of within court. And if you lie on an affidavit, the consequences are severe. We're talking imprisonment for a very, very long time. Not just for perjury, but the consequences for lying under oath. You have to swear the oath on a religious book, whether it be the Bible or the Quran or what have you. Most of law, as most people recognize, come from God's laws anyway. But, yeah, so it's a statement of truth. And this, I've done about three affidavits, three or four. An affidavit admit of truth. You basically are admitting it. Now, what you will see, I'm flicking through the Farrell report as I'm talking to you to find you a page where you can have a look at some of the listed productions, and believe me, they are many. There are many, and as my research shows that my work has been sold in 150 countries and has grossed colossal amounts of money, and it, which is the motivating factor for some of the horrors that I've experienced in the quieting, if you like, the silencing of the whole sorry affair. But basically that affidavit lists what was in my multimedia platform, basically, and what became a number of very famous TV productions. So I want people to get to see that. So I'm trying to flick while I'm talking to you here.
Yeah, the thing is, it's a 13 megabyte document, which means if I try to download it right now, I won't be able to hear you.
Okay, no, obviously you can't do it right now, but what I will do is give you the pages numbers.
Yeah. We're coming up to the top of the hour, so we'll be hearing this little piece of music soon. So what I'd like to do, in the next hour is, rather than drill down so deep into exact details of things.
Yes.
You've invented a new genre of TV shows.
Absolutely.
This is, you know, it's now common vision. Everybody sees them.
Yes.
Due credit hasn't been given to you.
Absolutely not.
Right? And worse than that, more than due credit, they've been hounding you ever since to shut you up.
Absolutely.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Now, but the other thing is, you've got other things to say.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it pays them to keep you quiet. So, in the next hour, I'd like you to really gloss over, because it's so big. It's so big, and it's like trying to describe an elephant if you're the size of an ant.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So let's break things down a little bit in the next hour, and then maybe you can come on my show next Sunday. And drill down a little bit more. So. Okay, so if we'll do that when the music comes round. So we're talking tonight with Seven, Ms. Seven, the seventh of seven. There we go. There's the numbers. So thank you very much, and don't go away. We'll be back after this break. You're listening to Revolution Radio. You're listening to Wolf Spirit Radio, and you're listening to No Borders Radio. Thank you very much. Yes, indeed. Your host, JP, speaking from the north of Scotland. And my guest tonight is Ms. Seven, speaking from somewhere in the south of England. we don't really mind. It's fine, wherever you might be. I just love listening to your voice, you know, because it's like, this is my home, wow. Is my home voice. It's so, wow. I just love listening to, because most of the time I hear different voices, you know. There's lots of Americans up here. There are not very many London voices.
Oh, right, okay.
It's a nourishment, so it's absolutely my pleasure. So,
thank you.
So you're an inventor. You created something out of
For my brother, basically.
Yeah, out of the emotional mix that came out of having to deal with a very sick brother a long, long time, and eventually having to let him go.
Mm.
So there's a lot of emotion in that, and you channeled all that, and you created this thing. Is, you know, why don't we do it like this? And presumably, then you. Did you like take it to any people? Did you say, look, I've got this idea, do you want to have a look at it?
No,
Or was it like you wanted to go to the lawyer first just to make sure? And that's immediately you stepped in the doo-doo right there.
Right away. I mean, it was straight away. I was always very confident of what I'd created because I did it from love. You know, it's like if you cook for somebody you love, you put everything in your being into it, you know. And I knew that it would translate because I did so much research. I met so many sick people. I met people suffering from drug abuse and all sorts of complaints. And it was just so clear to me, you know, there needed to be a way to connect with them. In a way that spoke their language, in a way that was contemporary and spoke about the issues that physically affected everybody, you know. And what's very disturbing for me now is to see that the work that I did is now being used for mind control, you know. To see what has come from something that was very pure is disturbing as well, you know, as well as everything else, you know. That's another insult.
So it's been weaponized, as they say.
It has. It's been used to pacify people, to distract them. It's been, you know, I mean, it's a bit like if you make money by illicit means, you know, you're gonna, if you know, generate large amounts of money, there isn't the respect and the intention and the actual understanding even that happens when somebody grafts for something. You know, when you work really hard for something and then you accumulate money, it's a different energy than people who accumulate it via crime. You know, there is a complete lack of respect and there's a sort of just a complete recklessness that comes with that. And obviously, you know, there are so many agendas that we're looking at today as well. You know, Agenda 21, the New World Order, whole thing, you know. I mean, what the work is funding is horrific. And to see that you create something born out of something that was pure for out of love, and it be, you know, taken into the hands of people that have no compassion, no love for anybody in humanity, and are using it to completely pacify large amounts of people. That, to me, is completely sickening. And that's part of the reason why I'm, you know, there are so many reasons why I'm vocal. To be honest, I don't really have a choice. You know, I'm not a wilting violet. I'm not the sort of, I'm not a coward. I don't actually fear any of these people. Never have done, never will. I see them as people that are very, very sick. and they're very sad human beings who lack compassion and lack love. And so I'm driven but from those types of reasons more than just the monetary side. But the monetary side is a factor as well, because, you know, you've got money in the wrong hands is power corrupting absolutely, because you've got people who have no consciousness, and on the back of the proceeds of organized crime like mine have propelled themselves to positions of power. You know, one of the women, Helen Alexander, she was on the list of the Bilderbergs. Recently, you know, we had all these protests in Watford, I believe, with Alex Jones and various other people showing up to bring it to the spotlight. And she was on one of the lists. And then you've got another person who's involved, who's part of the Leveson inquiry. Effectively, what you've got is criminals who've propelled themselves to positions of power to ensure that they never face any form of, accountability. So that in itself is, you know, there are so many factors, really. There are so many factors. So, I mean, it's up to you how far we go, you know. Yeah. I mean,
Like I said, I just wanted to, you know, skim over a few, and then maybe in a later show we can drill down into more detail on some of the issues that you've covered. So I tell you, one of the things that really caught my attention, 2007, I've been living in Scotland for at least 9 years by then, or I've certainly been away from London. But in the 1980s, I worked in London, and I worked in what was the hell name of that street? Anyway, I worked in University College London, right? It was the computer center, and it was right at the north end of UCL, and it was opposite MI5. And it was at the other end of this street was the Tavistock Institute. And the whole 7/7 event unfolded from that point there.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, although I'd been out of it for at least 15 years by then, it was still, you know, item of interest. Oh, look, that's interesting. You know, of course, I'd seen a building being demolished. And the moment I saw the Trade Center going down, I'd say that's a demolition. That's no, you know, that's no bloody plane dropping that thing. That's a demolition. I've seen that with my own eyes. I know what that looks like. And there's something wrong here. And so I was very interested very early on about what they call 9/11 truth. And I think actually they did us all a favor by, making such a blatant thing that is blatantly so stupid, as to, you know, oh, this is how, is, you know, is, this is a swamp gas kind of, you're not, you know, trying to do the old Jedi mind trick. And they are doing it because they traumatized everybody. And this is, you know, part of the whole, MK style mind control trauma technique.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know. You know, we've covered a lot of that. We know all about super soldiers. In fact, on Studio A, as we speak, they're having big conversations about super soldiers all of those people. So, so it's very interesting that you know, you bring up all of these subjects, and I've seen them, and I've been exposed to them from across the pond, as it were.
Yes.
And here you are in London. And I know, and we all know, that London is the center of it. So in a way, you're there reporting with your feet on the ground there. And it's unholy ground, and I have no, I'm not at all surprised that you've been allergic to even breathing the air, because it is toxic air. I tell you, come to Scotland, you'll make a difference, and you won't want to go back. Yeah. Once you breathe what air really tastes like, You won't want to go back because that's not the same. It's like walking into a room full of smokers.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, at the moment we've got a heat wave in London.
Oh, gross.
The chemtrailing is phenomenal. I mean, you cannot go to an open space without seeing. I mean, today was phenomenal. Any time you've got any form of people being outdoors, good weather, park activity, and the chemtrails is just unbelievable. It's just so blatant, you know. And we recently were in Sheffield, and I was amazed that it's not there. You can't see chemtrails like you do in London. Just looking at this stuff, I mean, this beast has tentacles in all sorts of areas, as we all know. And, you know, the more you look at it and you just think, I still, after all this time, cannot fathom the mindset of these individuals. I mean, how scared must these people be to be doing all that they're doing to, in some way, stop what is inevitable, the awakening of masses of people, the rising up of masses of people. They're terrified, and they're using all these different methods to silence the population by stealth. You know, you look at what's going on with Monsanto and the food. You can't go to a supermarket without buying some form of cancer in a bottle or in a jar. You know, it's unbelievable, and that's where we're at. But you're right. You're absolutely right. On the other side, they serve a purpose, because what they show us is that a large part of the population has been completely asleep. I mean, in my journey in 2003, once these people invaded my life, you know, there were a number of people around me who saw and, you know, witnessed things firsthand. But, you know, in trying to kind of let the wider community know about what was going on, I realized that there were so many people that were completely comatose. You know, they believed everything that was being said on the media, and they just couldn't even conceive of the sort of things that were going on. And that's partially why they do it, because they know that there is a certain amount of naivety and trust that has been afforded to these institutions such as media, the judiciary, etc. But however, several years on, it's a completely different playing field. We're looking at people that were completely comatose, being some of the best researchers I've ever come across. You know, a friend of mine used to complain about his siblings and his family members sitting in front of TV and not actually being hip to what's going on. Now, sending him information about the straw man and, you know, just understanding being a sovereign individual.
Lovely. When that ripple comes back, isn't it?
It's amazing. And like you said, because they serve a purpose, you know, they serve a purpose in that if we look at this holistically, we have a role to play. We are the catalysts of bringing to light some of the, you know, the poisons and the pus. But they are there to help us to do that in another way. You know, as ugly as it is, as horrible as it is, as painful as it has been for me in particular, I can see just being, you know, taking a step back and looking at this from the highest possible part of myself, because I've had to call upon that aspect of myself. And I give my brother tribute to that, because if he hadn't have taught me some of the things that he taught me, I wouldn't have been able to digest a lot of the things that I've experienced. And really, I've had to, you know, go straight to my heart to be able to to have the will to carry on, because it is, you know, you're attacked on a daily basis. I mean, I'm an ordinary member of the public. You know, I hadn't had any experience of organized crime. I hadn't had any experience of criminality in any shape or form beforehand. I never would have conceived that the things that I've experienced were actually taking place in the magnitude that they're taking place. And to actually deal with it, I've had to be able to see things from a completely different perspective and understand it from a spiritual point of view, because it is a spiritual warfare that we're dealing with. We're dealing with people that are parasitical, people that largely, I mean, if you look at Common Purpose, you know, the whole way Common Purpose is operating, it's neuro-linguistic programming of people working in public offices.
Right, hang on a second. Not everybody knows who or what Common Purpose is. Now,
okay.
Now, I've heard of them.
Okay.
Because I have a friend who is very up on Agenda 21 and all the different things. Now, NLP, neuro-linguistic programming, is essentially Jedi mind tricks in a manual.
Yes.
And
basically,
you can go on the internet and learn about this, can't you? You can go to a YouTube and find out how to persuade somebody to say something by moving your hand in various gestures and talking to the subconscious mind while keeping the conscious mind asleep.
Absolutely.
So,
and it's very cult orientated as well. I mean, it's very from my experience of these individuals, they're very cult.
Yeah.
They operate. They're very external.
They work in packs as well.
Yes, absolutely.
What Common Purpose tend to do is to infiltrate meetings of things that may be against, you know, that may be like people speaking for themselves and being individual and having their own opinion and things like that. You know, those kind of thought crimes, Common Purpose is well against. And they're really, you know, they're like the self-righteous twats that you used to have at school. That's where they go. That's where they end up.
And it's also quite psychopathic. A lot of these people seem to have a very psychopathic nature and narcissistic. They have this kind of superiority way of perceiving themselves and to be above other individuals and to be what they consider to be elite. I mean, this word elite, I don't like to use it at all, particularly in the context of people that I consider to be low caliber individuals. People that I've experienced are lower than animals. I've seen animals that are much more compassionate and loving to their fellow clans than these individuals are. And you have to ask yourself what kind of individual gets to a point in themselves where they can justify doing some of the crimes against humanity that are taking place right now. You know, it has had me perplexed for many a moment, I can tell you, just trying to understand, because in the silencing operation, I mean, some people might be aware of what's called gang stalking. And gang stalking is the method that they use in order to silence the individual they want silencing. And what's gang stalking is, if you break it down, it's individuals working in corrupt organizations using their manpower, resources, and economic power to infiltrate the person they want silenced life in every shape and form. So I'll give you an example. For instance, I live in social housing. I live in a housing association property. And what they will do is they'll infiltrate that housing association, if not buy it up altogether and take it over. And they will infiltrate where you live. So one of the first things we saw was, besides the surveillance van, which are very visible, because part of it, the way that it plays out, they want you to know that you're being watched. They want you to know that you're being stalked. They want to send the message to terrify you. It's part of the psyops, is it called psyops?
Psychological operation.
Yeah, it's part of their way of trying to break your spirit, because that's what they aim to do, is to break you as an individual so that you're so terrified. And what they'll do, they'll infiltrate your building. For instance, they showed up while I was in court in 2006, a woman called Elizabeth Milner, working for Genesis Housing, who are the housing association whose property I live in. Elizabeth showed up on my door while I was in court, during the period that I was in court, and said, oh, we've got to remove all your smoke alarms and replace them by a new system. Now, I knew automatically that this was to put in surveillance inside the building, because they were monitoring the building externally, but they wanted to have the equipment on the inside. And what they said was that Westminster City Council had introduced a new law that stated that it was mandatory for all properties to have this system put in, to be installed. Now, when I actually contacted my neighbors and asked around the neighborhood that I live, that are with Genesis Housing's properties, because some of the properties in my area are private, but I went to all the other residents living in a Genesis property and asked, are you having this new system put in? And they said, no, we've never heard of it. And I mean, even before I asked, I knew exactly what this was. And what this was covert surveillance. Because they want to monitor you and every move that you make. Basically, they want to put you in a goldfish bowl and work out who you're talking to, when you're talking to them, where you go, who you speak to, so that they can sabotage at every point. You know, any time you try to seek help or anybody to bring this to light, they want to be able to circumvent it. So that's the reason why they infiltrate where you live. The other thing they did with me is while I was in hiding, these two men showed up outside the building at my entrance, the front door entrance to my property, and pulled out the water pipes, and they poisoned the water supply. There's photographs of that in the Farrow Report. I think it's on page, if you go to page 42... 142, sorry, and 143. If you skip forward, you'll see these men. Because I was actually, at that point, I'd been in hiding for about 5 months. I basically barricaded myself inside the property. And to flush me out, if you like, they actually sent these men to poison my water supply. So I heard the pipes under my floorboards in the living room, I could hear them like crackling and creaking, and I thought, what the hell's going on? So I went to the window, my bathroom window, which you can see above to the front door below, and lo and behold, I saw these two men, and they're photographed here on page 142. I'm pulling out the pipes for my water supply, and I've also provided a photograph so people can see what the water's like in my property. There's also some photographs of to show when they break into your property. They smash the doors, they remove the locks, they remove plug sockets from the wall, like electrical plug sockets. One day I went in and I saw all the sockets in my flat had been removed and replaced. You could see that they were in a different position. Saw big footsteps all across the floors. My floors are white, so you could see everything. And I've had someone from ex-military, a surveillance expert, who actually, he's an activist as well, actually, and they discovered my circumstances and came to scan my property for bugging devices. And on page 142, you can see there's the device that the young man used shows a reading. And usually it's basically a little gadget, which is like got a radio air sort of aerial attached. And they'll go throughout the property, they'll go to various different points in the property, and when the actual device starts making a bleeping sound and flashes, that's when it detects that there are bugging devices within the property. Now, the photograph that you can see on 142 of the FARA report shows that device bleeping, and you can see all the lights are lit up to indicate a positive reading of finding bugging devices. So that's another thing that they do. Another thing that they do, and I mention this specifically because there are other targeted individuals out there, and since my report has gone live, I've had people contact me with the same, suffering from the same situations. One of the things they do, they put scaffolding on your building, particularly if they want to carry out a hit. If they think that you're becoming a danger or a threat, and you know you're, there's a potential that you're going to, you know, be successful in any way of getting the information out there, you'll wake up one morning to hear scaffolding being put onto your windows. In my case, they left scaffolding on my building for almost 17 months, largely because once they put it up there, I actually vacated. I went and I basically slept on people's sofas because a friend of mine said, first they'll attack your finances, then they'll attack where you live, they'll attack your estate or whatever, and then they'll attack you physically. And so the scaffolding was a clear indication that they wanted to carry out some sort of hit on me, so I vacated. But that's a typical thing that they do to targeted individuals. They hire these rogue scaffolders that will put the scaffolding up and remove it. There won't be any proper legitimate names of who the scaffolders are, so that there are no records to trace who it is that have put the scaffolding there. In my case also, I've been burgled. I mean, that's something that happens for targeted individuals on a frequent basis. I've been burgled last year alone six times. Six times I've got home and the door was open, and they do it in such a way that they want you to know that they're doing it. It's not done so that you don't know. I mean, part of the whole targeting thing is to freak you out, to psych you out, you know, and to make you afraid. But what I did, I'm not a person that, you know, I don't do fear. Fear is not an option for me. What it did for me was made me empowered. It made me more and more angry. It made me more and more determined. And it gave me a lot of evidence, because everything that they did, I actually documented it and photographed it. And that's why I have a large body of evidence right now. Over the last 10 years, I mean, I documented everything. All the vans that stalked me, everything that was being done to me was recorded. And the only time I didn't actually record things was because I just got bored. I had so much of it, I thought, you know, you guys are boring me now, you know. But that's a very important thing. You know, if you are being targeted, if there are some very sinister things going on around you and you suspect that you're being targeted because you're exposing something, what I would say is to collect evidence. It's very, very important. I mean, even though truth has a frequency that deceit doesn't have, you can always tell when someone's telling the truth, and you can tell when someone's bullshitting. So even though you are able, because I've met targeted individuals, women in particular, who didn't gather evidence, but I knew that they were telling me the truth. They were in tears. They said, I've heard your story. This is happening to me. And they explained their circumstances. And I knew that they were telling the truth. But in the real world, how it works is that you have to have proof. You have to have evidence. And in my case, I documented absolutely everything. Everything is on public record. There is a long crime file because I've been smuggled to police stations in the past. So everything that I allege, or, you know, all the allegations that I make are all recorded. So there's no way for them to be able to get out of it. Obviously, what they also do is they hire perps, what's called perps. So their perp is, it's an abbreviation for perpetrator. And what a perp does is they're a hired service operative. So they're somebody who's paid to ridicule you and to try to discredit you in some way. They'll leave nasty comments and they'll troll around and leave, if you make an interview or radio interview that's put on the internet, they'll leave really nasty comments about it and say that you're mad and blah, blah, blah. But that's something that comes with the territory. You don't get a cover up without them paying people to actually silence it. So, well, when you see that, often when you see truth coming out, if you don't see like a barrage of insulting comments, you have to question whether it or not it is the truth, actually. It's a bit bizarre, but that's the truth in this day and age. They do hire people to silence everything. But as I said before, you know, everything that we see like this is designed on another level to help us to ascend. Because it takes something as evil as this to make people wake up and make people recognize and empower themselves. Because quite often in society, people are externalizing power. They're projecting their power externally. They're saying, okay, he's a doctor, he's a lawyer, he's a this, he wears this, he works here. And so they're making these people important. But the power really lies within us. And that's the important thing to always remember. We cannot give people power who do not warrant it. You know, we have to look within ourselves and to empower ourselves in order to help them ascend as well. Because these people are operating on a very, very, very low frequency, on a very low basis. They're very fear-based. Very animalistic, even though I say animalistic, and I know that there are animals that are more compassionate than they are. You know, sometimes I find it difficult to try to understand, because in life you have to see the other person's point of view, no matter how bad the situation is. We are always called to look at the other person's point of view. How is it that this human being has found themselves in a position where they want to murder other people, they want to steal from other people, they want to harm other people? How did they get there? And as a collective consciousness and a collective society, we're all one. We all contribute in some way or another. And our silence contributes to that person becoming a monster. And there is a relationship between ourselves and them to help them ascend. So that's partially what motivates me as well. You know, apart from having a responsibility to try to, you know, just to set the record straight and help the people that have been affected to know what happened, what really happened, who was really involved. You know, rather than speculating, there's a lot of armchair kind of philosophers out there who say that 7/7 happened because of X, Y, Z and the other, and they weren't there. You know, it's, a lot of it is designed to lead you down the wrong path in the first place. So
that's the idea.
You know, I mean, yeah, absolutely.
That's why it's a scatter bomb that works on multiple dimensions. Because
absolutely.
First of all, it gets you involved with the physical, oh God, people were damaged, you know, mm-hmm. And then, oh, somebody has to be blamed, And then the whole stink about that all kind of blows up. And then what's that all about? Oh, well, that's because of this and this is because of that and because of them. And yeah, and the whole thing just is whipped up by the frenzied media.
Yeah. Yes.
So, yes.
Yeah.
So that, and that's the point you get to. And, but the thing is, what we, and all the people who are listening to this program right now, and who will also be listening to the archives, and there are many of those, is that we know that there is a cabal, right? We know that they are involved with the Federal Reserve. We know that they're involved with the Rockefeller family. We know that they're involved with the Rothschild family. We know that this has got something to do with the Bilderbergers. We know that this has got something to do with the Vatican and London and the Zionists and the Khazarians and the Pope and the Black Pope and the Jesuits and the Archons. And it all comes down to, you know, that's where it all, that, you know, that's the kind of hierarchy of evil. You know, that's all becoming really clear, and it all comes down to, you know, and it all gets transmitted through a pedophile network, and they use drugs to raise money to pay for their flying saucers that they're trying to get away from the planet, just in time for the big changes to happen, and then they can come back, having all the changes happen, lord it back up. And that's where, this is where we're at right now, that they're trying to leave the planet.
Yeah, that's why we've got underground bunkers and all sorts of space excavations and whatever. I mean, they're trying to, they recognize that there will be a mass awakening. If you can look at what happened in Brazil as a you know, way, an example, if you like. Now, a year ago, it was said that a year ago, they couldn't get 100 people to be on the street and demonstrate in Brazil. And then, like, a month, 2 months ago, they had something like 100 cities, wall-to-wall cities full of people outside in the streets. And they are anticipating in the UK, they're anticipating a rising, an uprising to happen. And it is scheduled to happen because, you know, they've gone too far. They've gone too far, and they've done it several times in history before, but we're in a different place right now. We're in a place where we have the internet. We have spiritual forces as well. You know, I mean, there are lots of, aides, and there are lots of, people who cannot be bribed, in mass. We have rainbow tribes of people that are like ourselves, are committed to truth, committed to change, you know, and that's what we know we've come here to do. You know, I believe that I was targeted because of there's a divine reason for that, you know, and there is a mass awakening of people right now, and it's growing by the minute. It's growing, as I said to you before, in 2005, trying to talk to people and tell people what was going on. You know, I was dealing with comatose zombies. It was like people were completely asleep. A few years on, and the same people are completely, it's 180 degrees changed, you know, they now get it. They now see exactly what's going on. And that is happening on a daily basis. And so they recognize that it's only a matter of time. It's a question of time before people literally bombard their buildings. People pull them out of their offices. You know, what happened in Bulgaria recently will happen here. What happened in Iceland will happen here. It is scheduled to happen here, and they know this, and they're trying desperately to be able to evade it in some way, but that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen. The thing is, we have all this stuff kicking off, but we need to be focused on solutions. And obviously, part of the solution is to bring the truth to the forefront so that people do know what's happened. I'm hoping and praying that these people recognize that they have to confess what they've done. You know, that it's out there. They recognize that the world is watching them. You know, it's no longer a situation where people are speculating. We have the Farrer Report. We have all sorts of great people like, what's his name, David Hawkins? Is it David Hawkins?
David Hawkins and Field McConnell. Yes, abledanger.net.
Yes. That's
A-B-E-L,
right.
A-B-E-L, as in Cain and Abel, danger. They really spell out the truth behind the organization of the cabal who organize these false flag events.
Absolutely.
Which all have a pattern. They all have, there's going to be a military exercise, they all have, and this is something
crisis
that they've been
done
for that years, these insurance policies, catastrophe bonds. The way that the catastrophe bond for the Twin Towers was funded by the police and the fire brigade's pension fund. That's where the big insurance policy money comes from. It comes from investments from pension funds through these catastrophe bonds. And so it's essentially, these are big insurance jobs, as we call them in London. It's an insurance job.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which involve, not only, I mean, basically they take out life insurance policy of all the people who die. And you know, they make money, what's the word? Hand over fist? Something like that. Loads of it. All, you know, vast amounts of it from all these things. And of course they, you know, they get to change laws into their favor.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's also a ritualistic side as well, obviously. You know, in as much as they put the information out there, prior to, during, and after these events, you'll see embedded into scripts and movies, TV shows, publications, they will be littered with information pertaining to an event taking place, how it's going to take place. I mean, that's how I knew 7/7 was about to take place. And you know, I was actually alerting people about it in June of 2005 and actually was trying to take an injunction out on the criminal cartel. But unfortunately, I was already scheduled to be in court in July of 2005. So there was no way that I was going to be able to mount proceedings to stop them blowing up the trains as well.
Okay. So, that's seven. Can you name the names? Can you actually give us names out on the air now? Are there any legal boundaries to you doing that?
No, absolutely not. Why not
lay it down and say, look, these are the people, and if they ever get to hear this, well, I think it's too late.
Well, the Farrer Report is out there, and it actually names them as well. But just so that the public is aware, we have 10 individuals and corporations in that were involved in my case, and these individuals have direct links to what transpired on 7/7, the 7/7 attacks, and also the shooting of Jean-Charles Menendez. Jean-Charles happens to be my family name, and I was in hiding at the time, and when the bombs went off, I mean, I tried to warn people a month beforehand, and when I couldn't take injunctions and nobody would help me, the police wouldn't act, I ended up going into hiding. And so basically at that time I saw everything kick off. They actually were letting me know very, very clearly that they had, what they had planned for me. And so, anyway, coming back to your question, because it's such a big subject, it's difficult to enter it at one point and not conclude it, but perhaps on another time.
Yeah,
that
we're
going
to have to continue this further down the road, maybe on Sunday or... But let's dangle a few carrots in front. Let's have some names, and we'll deal with why and how, but just the who's. And then people can do some research. People can Google these names, cross-reference them with criminal activities and all sorts of things. So give people some Google search terms in bullet points.
Okay.
Because we've got about 7 minutes left or something like that.
Okay. All right. So you've got Christopher Gossage, who was in Russell's media law firm. Now, you will remember that there was a reference to Russell's, the number 30 bus being left on Russell Square with the sign, "Outright Terror, Bold and Brilliant," plastered as a placard on the bus. So Russell's media law firm, you'll see that Russell's comes up quite a lot. There's Russell's Athletic. I believe they've opened schools. I believe they've opened all kinds of things, but that name Russell's, you'll see that it features quite often. But so Russell's media law firm, Christopher Gossage, from there, and also another man called Tony English, who's the principal partner in that law firm. Then we've got Richard Hanna. He was working for NTL, and they've since disbanded and called themselves Virgin Media. But since my releasing this report, myself and Tony Farrell releasing this report, they've sold Virgin Media to someone called Liberty Corporation. They're still currently using the name Virgin Media, but it has been sold to Liberty. So then there's Helen Alexander. She, while I was in hiding during 7/7 bombings, I wrote, amongst the hundreds of people I wrote to for help to get out of there, was City of London Police. And actually, I've recently seen that she's now very, very affiliated with City of London Police. And it appears that she's now a Bilderberger, and she was with Scottish Media Groups, with another man called Jim Manson. And Jim Manson famously also pretended to be an eyewitness to a terrorist attack, which he had obviously staged himself in Glasgow Airport. And if you go onto Scottish Media Group's website, and in fact they've also changed their name in 2006, they changed their name to Scottish TV, again to conceal their activities. But if you go onto Scottish TV website, that's if they haven't pulled it down since us outing these people, you'll see there should be a footage of Jim Manson pretending to be the witness, eyewitness in the attack on Glasgow Airport in, I believe it was 2007. But in fact, when you look at this footage, you'll see that the whole thing's been staged. There are no people there. He happens to be the only eyewitness who supposedly witnessed these Muslim so-called terrorists doing these atrocities. And again, the police station that I had been reporting him, Helen Alexander, Richard Hanna, and a whole bunch of them to, is exactly the same place in London where they took the people that they were trying to frame. So that's the kind of madness that we've got going on. Another person to look out for is Tamsin Allen. Now, Tamsin Allen works for a law firm called Beinman & Partners. Beinman & Partners' names come up again and again and again, and in fact, there is the court hearing tomorrow in Isleworth Court in, I can't remember exactly what station, but the hearing is Isleworth, I think it's Crown Court, at, I believe that the hearing will be scheduled for about 1 p.m., 1 or 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon, with Cor Grant, Now, Cor Grant is another long-standing victim of Byman and Partners, whose son died in suspicious circumstances. And he has himself been a targeted individual for the best part of two decades. And so Byman and Partners, their name comes up again and again. I get witnesses and victims from them come to me after finding out about my case very, very often. So I want to alert people, do not go to that law firm. They pretend to be a human rights law firm, but in fact what they're doing is they're an organized crime cartel. It's a front for an organized crime cartel. And they are luring in innocent members of the public and terrorizing them. So be very careful about that law firm.
Ms. Seven.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, I've got two more names.
Do you have a website?
The Farrell Report at the moment. You can see
lots of... That's thefarrellreport.net. That's thefarrellreport.net. Now, this is really important. What this stuff contains is the criminal cabal that is the kind of London R branch of the 9/11 conspirators. Let's put it that way.
7/7.
Yeah, it's the same modus operandi. It stems from the Bullingdon Club of Oxford. This is their MO, and David Cameron and Boris Johnson and Nathan Rockefeller, they've all been part of this, and their MO is to destroy a restaurant that they've taken insurance out on. They start a fight, they create destruction, they destroy everything in the restaurant, give the owner loads and loads of money, throw money at him, literally, plenty enough to fix the whole thing up. But they've already taken out an insurance policy to cover the expense of doing so. That's their initiation ceremony. And so both Boris Johnson and David Cameron have done that. They are destructive, and they're part of this whole thing.
Yes, I've spoken to Boris Johnson. I can hear him coming up for a good break.
No, this is the end of the program. Thank you very much, Miss Evan. So, join us next week.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me, and thanks to all the listeners out there. Please look at the report, and hopefully I'll see you again sometime. I'll speak again sometime. Thank you.